Yeah, good evening. Thank you for coming. Happy fall. Anybody here for the first time? Yeah, welcome. I don't know what you're expecting. Anything? Whatever. That's good. Okay, thank you so much. So what we're normally calling prayers is actually narrative meditations. I call them narrative because we're saying things and they have a purpose. We technically shouldn't call them discursive because discursive means wandering, but maybe sometimes they are discursive, you know. But they're narrative in the sense that they're meant to engage our intellect but also our emotions so that we're developing gratitude, we're developing aspirations, we're developing renunciation, we're finally with the Heart Sutra developing right understanding or right view. In the Buddhist tradition, right view or right understanding is the first of the Eightfold Path. And that's really what we're training to is we're training to right understanding, right view, so that the noble truths become actual experiential truths for us. In the Buddhist tradition, the Buddha just said, well, this is the truth. I've discovered the truth, and here it is. And he just laid it out. It's different from a revelation from a God or a revelation that is totally private or secret, because he said, if you do the practices and you look carefully, you'll discover the same truths yourself. But he did start out with, this is the truth, and I'm just telling you. I've done a lot of practice. I had an awakening, and this is actually the way things are. This is important because a lot of times in Western education and a lot of times when we're kind of spiritual seekers, we tend to think like, well, there are a lot of different truths and, you know, we're kind of seeking and you have to kind of try things on and investigate, which is true to a degree. But classically, we read texts and then like sutras or lectures of the Buddha or commentaries, and then we try to practice and make those true for ourselves. We do investigate our own mind so we're clear that it's true for us. But I know as a Westerner too, a lot of times, you know, I'd begin by reading Heart Sutra like this and kind of go, well, maybe, I don't know. It's not my experience. So maybe that's true, maybe it's not. I just want to meditate. Does that make sense? Has anybody else ever thought that way? Like, I don't know, this is kind of like, well, whatever, but it's good to do some meditation. Helps me calm down. Yeah. 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 So it is classic in the Buddhist tradition to say, I don't understand it, but enlightened people, Buddhists, have experienced that, so that's a truth that I'm trying to understand. So I'm always depressed if people say, oh, I read the Heart Sutra. Yeah, I understand that. It's really depressing. But it's the same way, you know, like, I mean, I accept a lot of scientific proofs, Western science, about atoms and molecules and quarks and electricity and black holes, right? And I haven't personally experienced any of that, never looked at an electron microscope, and, you know, I haven't done any of that, but I accept it on a certain kind of authority. Why I'm saying this is because classically we come together to hear Dharma, and then the meditations we do are to establish in our own mind stream, in our own heart, the truth of what we just heard. because it goes faster that way. It's a little bit like the Buddha's. We'd say, well, you know, how do you get down to the courthouse downtown? And we just say, well, you just head down I Street to go to, you know, 8th Street or something. You know, it's just very direct like that. But a lot of times when we're doing prayers and guided meditations or narrative meditations, we kind of skip over it and we figure, well, that's just kind of warm-up time and that's not the real thing. The real thing is when we're sitting quietly. But actually, traditionally, is most from within the tradition from India and Tibet, most of the time when we're sitting quietly, we're just making up a lot of silly stories. So the teachers want you to at least understand intellectually or verbally what the truths are. So, you know, there's some simple truths that we have to repeat, even though we might have evidence of it. Like, you know, simple truths that, you know, some of us are dealing with because we, you know, just recently had a Sangha member pass away, is that we're going to die. So we don't really have to. Maybe we could pretend, well, not me, but, you know, we hear the truth, but we still have to really take it to heart. So all the Buddhist teachings are really kind of on that level. The Buddha said, you know, this should just be obvious, but I know when we're confused, it doesn't look obvious. Like, all composite things are impermanent. That should just be like, oh, well, yeah. But actually, we don't really take that to heart that often. We're really annoyed when things, you know, change, right? We're just, you know, like that. So the truths actually are quite simple, but it takes a long time for them to become part of our personal experience. So intellectually in the West, we might kind of think, well, is that really true? And there are intellectual systems in Buddhism too. But we are invited to just kind of like consider that actually is true and then what would be the consequences of that. So that's why we do these narrative meditations. So that someone's telling us like, you know, this is actually the situation, and then what are you going to do with it? So when there's a silent period after a teaching or a reading, we're actually meant to review that truth in our mind. When you're going to a teaching or just even a service, generally people are not doing what we call shamatha or mindfulness meditation in the Tibetan tradition or Vajrayana tradition. You're doing that at home or on retreat because you're at least meant, in a short period like we have tonight, you're at least meant to like take one section or take something from the narrative meditations, the prayer that hits you, and really let that sink in. So we're not really meant to kind of like, okay, there was the prayers, and now I'm just going to do mindfulness of breathing. I've taught that because I know people need to hear that because I'm not going over their house and telling them. But actually in a setting like this where we're actually doing a meditation on what we've just heard or what we've just read. So it sinks in. Just a couple of weeks ago, more than a couple of weeks, maybe last month, a really old Sangha member that none of you knew that used to come and meditate when we met on Watt Avenue. I saw his obituary in the Sacramento Bee. Phil Segovia. And I just ended up doing a meditation on that. You know, it wasn't like I read that and then, I'm going to go just pay attention to my breath. You know, I just it just sunk in. You know, and just thought about Phil and things we've done and let it sink in that I haven't seen him for a long time and he gone. So that's the meditation. I didn't have to analyze is it true or whether he died or not or is there really death? It's just, you know, you let it sink in. So the meditation is you're taking it in and letting the truth become a real felt experience. We do intellectual things where we do generally debate and discussion. Like somebody will say something and we go, well, how do you know that or why is that true? But the deepest meditations is we're hearing something and then we're really letting it sink in. Usually we really let, you know, bad news or startling news sink in, right? But we can't let really good news sink in. You just won the lottery. Okay, let that sink in, or I don't know. So actually Dharma is supposed to be really good news, actually. So I'm fond of talking about Chariputra, who was a Brahmin and didn't want to embarrass himself by going to hear one of the Buddhist talks with all the other folks. So he just asked somebody leaving the lecture, what did Siddhartha say? What did this fellow who calls himself the Buddha say? And one of the attendees replied, well, I really don't know. I was just dropping by the lecture myself, but he said something to the effect that everything that arises disappears. Everything that's born dies. And as people know, Shariputta had an instant opening right there. That's really taking it in, right? That was an instant, kind of instant samadhi, instant meditation. He didn't, say, maybe, Of course, he'd done a lot of practice, and so when he heard that truth, it really dropped all the way to the bottom of the well and made a nice splash. So that's true for even the deepest and highest levels of meditation in our tradition, Mahamudra and Dzogchen, where at some point the teacher usually makes a remark that just completely sinks in. One of the more famous ones that comes to mind is when Patra Rinpoche, who was an incredible Dzogchen teacher in the 19th century, was studying with his rather unconventional teacher, Dokense. And Dokense, it was in the middle of the night or something, and they were just lying on the ground looking up at the stars. Which is a good meditation, by the way. And Kensei just said, do you hear the dogs barking? And Pachal said, yes. And then what did Kensei say? And you should know this story, right? Just said, that's it. And Kensei had Patra Rinpoche had an incredible opening right there. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, so sometimes we need that direct speech that, is a truth, your own, just little short gloss on that is your own immediate direct experience is it, folks. So that was a meditation on that truth, you see. But it was a deep meditation because you'd done a lot of practice and it went already in. So in our tradition, it and other religious traditions too, like words and said at the right time in the right place can be and are enormously powerful. So I've mentioned a bunch of times, regulars here are fond of me saying, you know, at the right time in the right place, when someone says, I love you, that might change your world or would change your world. At the right time in the right place, or maybe not the right place, when somebody says, I want a divorce, that could change your world, right? You know, you might go, well, that's not happening. But at some point you go, well, that's happening. So that's a narrative meditation. That's a style of narrative meditation where the truth proclaimed is just so obvious that we just surrender to it. So that's why we do a lot of the prayers and meditations that I know at this point are kind of formulaic, but there might be a time where we're reading through these and saying them together, and one of you or all of us together, who knows, could just all of a sudden go, I've read that a million times, but now it got me. You know, it's just like, and you can just feel like your whole kind of inner being and universe like shift. Where it's just, you know, you're just reading things that you might have met, you know, like just, you know, easy, may all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. And we've read that a million times, and then it just kind of like floods you, right? That's a meditation. So there have been wonderful teachers in the past where they're just kind of, you know, reading these out, and you can tell just by them doing the prayers themselves, each one is kind of like on that level. It's really profound. So I invite people to, you know, take a little meditation time now. See if there's one phrase you might you might have to open up your book again. I don't know. But, you know, is there anything in, you know, the prayers and in the sutra itself that really, really hits you? Like you just can't, you know, it's just really, really there. And that you allow to sink in. So it's not that we're not trying to block out these truths and then go to some kind of blank out state where we're taking the truths in and making them real. And then it's so real you don't have to think about it anymore. It's so immediately and obvious that you don't have to have any doubt. You don't go, well, I don't know, is this really happening or not? Usually we're doing that. Usually human beings are kind of going, well, I don't know, maybe it's not really happening. I don't know. You know, we're in that kind of funny world. But there's some things where, like, this is really happening. This is not something that you back out of. Like, some obvious things that, you know, like, of course, being when someone passes away is one of those. Where also when you're around a birth, a live birth, then a baby comes popping out, and like, well, that's one you don't back out of, right? You don't just say, well, this didn't, I don't know, it didn't really happen, you know. So like that. But a lot of times with their own personal experience, we're in this kind of very fuzzy place where, I don't know, did they really mean that? did I really mean that when I thought that myself? Did that really happen? You know, we're in that kind of funny, fuzzy place. I don't know. I kind of like Sacramento, but then again, sometimes I don't. You know, and, you know that world where it's not a real meditative world. The we're kind of on the surface and we're having all that. So finding a word that in the next, say we sit here for 12 or 18 minutes, that like just that's a phrase or that's a word that you that's going to drop all the way to the bottom of your well and make a splash. Can we give that a try? Okay. Do you want to ask a question? Like, am I being clear? So you're. Yeah. Okay. Let you know. Thank you for reminding me. Got the bell in. Yay, I'm learning. Was that easy or difficult? Difficult today. Can be difficult. Basically, our culture, in many ways, educational, is kind of scientific, meaning we have a scientific model in the sense that we are agnostic or doubting about what's actually real, but we believe in the methodology of it, of science, okay? So we're not sure, like, is the universe expanding or maybe it is, or Big Bang, or how many quarks are there really in an atom? We're not sure, but we believe in the scientific technology and the scientific hypothesis in general, right? So in other words, we've become skeptical somewhat about the what we're starting with, and maybe even what we end with, but we're very believers in the methodology, something like that. So in a way that's really cool, because it's very innovative, but it's also different than the way Buddha Dharma works. And that's why a lot of times I notice, you know, when we're trained kind of as kids in the scientific worldview and then we try to do Buddha Dharma, it gets really confusing. And also, I have an issue with scientific types who try to equate Buddhism and science. And I mean, they might arrive at some of the same truths, but also it's okay to not, right? But the truths, like the Four Noble Truths, are put as truths, and then we're meant to see. We're meant to use the methodology to arrive at the same conclusion experientially. In Buddhism, this style is actually the way we learn as human beings. Because as kids, we're not taught by our parents or caregivers to be skeptical. We're just said, well, that's, you know, now you're walking. This is mama, this is daddy, this is daddy, this is daddy, whoever is mama, this is mama, you know. So we're taught just, you know, just this is the way it is. We're taught a normative reality. You know, this is the cat. Cat, you know, says meow. You know, we're not taught skeptical worldview. Unless we're from a dysfunctional family like mine. So we're taught something that looks like it's the truth, but then there's a second one going on, right? So that screws you up. So, but let's just say we're having the a wonderful Dharma family and we're just teaching kids. So we're just having, we're just saying this is, for a long time, we're saying to children, this is the way it is. We're not starting out skeptical. This is the way it is, so learn how to do it like that. And so kids actually learn coming from, in a sense, from that positive point of view. But a lot of times, with Western education, which I'm not trashing, there's a really important aspect too, but we become skeptical about what's really happening, but we still believe in the methodology. We kind of believe in the outcome. But classical Dharma is a little bit like classical philosophy in the West, that there are these axioms and you start from there to see whether they're true or not. Because developmentally, we actually start from something and then test it. We don't really start from a place of skepticism. We start from a place of complete, immediate knowing. So that's the model, and that's why the emphasis, particularly with Mahayana Dharma, not only beginning but advanced, like Mahamudra and Dzogchen, is it's a return to what you already know, rather than producing something we didn't know and arriving at a truth that we didn't know before. It's going to be an uncovering or a realization of what's already there. But when we have a model that's kind of a little bit more continuous improvement model, there's a style of business coaching that was started in America, became popular in Japan, like continuous improvement. Then we're always kind of moving forward instead of establishing what's already there. There's a neat part to continuous improvement because Dharma's dynamic too, but it's based on a model that the truth is already there, you know, like X-Files, you know, truth is already there, and we're just more and more waking up to it, rather than we don't know what's going on, so we've got to do this methodology to find out what's going on. It starts with, actually, we do know what's going on, but then we get confused. So it's based on what Buddha Dharma believes is how actually human beings learn. Because if we try to do Dharma different than how we've kind of learned or how we've grown up as hopefully, you know, sane human beings, then it's going to be really difficult to make sense of all this stuff. So, you know, maybe the most positive thing, hopefully, we hear as kids is we love you. That's the truth, right? So we just get, we love you, right? We hear it, you know, hopefully. As kids, we're going to hear that, but then gradually it becomes more and more clear, like what that means, we love you, or what it is to love. But of course, if we don't say that to kids, or we don't say anything nice, there's still going to be, you know, it's going to be a lot of confusion. Or if we say, we don't like you, you weren't meant to be born, and you're a nuisance, then that's going to create trouble too. Because we, as kids, we're just, you know, like sponges, right? We're like little mini Buddhas, little Buddhas, and we're just going to believe exactly what we hear and take it in. So that's why, you know, we're like this little pitch, like our little Buddha program, educational program, you know, it's easier actually to grow human beings properly than later trying to fix them in our 30s and 40s when we're screwed up. So, you know, I include myself, you know. So, but the Buddha Dharma starts with, here's something that's already true, you already know, you probably have forgotten it or overlooked it. So we're just going to keep telling you. And there is a methodology to find out what's true and false, but it's first going to always be starting with, this is true. Let's have a little discussion, because this all sounds maybe either so obvious or too abstract, but really you got to get this, because if we start off kind of like, I don't really know what's going on, but I don't believe anything, but I've got a methodology, we can probably circle around in kind of like a lot of doubt for a long time. Like, I don't know, maybe it's true, maybe it isn't. Maybe I'm Bodhisattva, maybe I'm not. Maybe the Buddha was made up, maybe it's not. You know, I mean, we'll just circle around in doubt forever. So at some point you have to say, well, this is an island of truth I'm going to stand on and work from there. Yes. Well, it looked like Susan made the first. Susan's very subtle. She must go to a lot of you know, auctions where you just make a little.
You know, I didn't pick something from the prayers to meditate on, but I ended up there, and where I ended up was a version of. The Brahma Viharas that starts out with wouldn't it be wonderful if all sentient beings had happiness and the causes of happiness? I myself will cause them to have the happiness and the causes of happiness. Please, Guru Deity, grant me blessings to be able to do this. And the way that I came to that I felt that I wasn't responsible for something, and you're never not responsible. You're always responsible. You're always, you know, and things may get screwed up or they may not get screwed up, but you're always responsible. And that's just the truth. You're just always responsible. Because if you're on a bodhisattva path, you're always responsible. You just don't ever say, oh, let so-and-so take care of it. I'm tired. I'm out of town. And it's not my deal. You know, it's not the way it is. The truth is you're always responsible. And it comes through the Brahma Viharas. When you make the pledge, you know, that I myself am responsible for people who have happiness.
Yeah, like that. Karmic truth. Like, I like to say, sometimes I like to say, we're always in the middle of it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, when people say, I don't want to be in the middle of it. Right, yeah, I just don't want to get in the middle. You are in the middle of it.
Right. Speaking in the middle of it, yeah. And like, I just went, no, I don't want to be in the middle of this. Bye. And it didn't
right.
work.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, big one, karma. Yeah, totally.
what you were saying about, you know, being in doubt all the time. That's why I became a Buddhist, because I realized that. Well, I decided that I needed to decide what direction I was going to follow, and then I had to decide what direction that would be, and it's kind of, you know, in a way I've decided to limit myself by saying I'm going to focus on this path, I'm going to focus on these things, I'm going to experience these things to the exclusion of a bunch of other things that I used to pursue. I mean, I wanted to know everything. I wanted to study everything. I wanted to learn everything. And I'm still, you know, I'm interested in a lot of things, but it's come to where I feel it's more beneficial for me to just focus on this path. And so what you're saying is sort of advice that I wish I had taken when I was 20.
Uh-huh, sure, yeah. Well, it's not really a question as much as I'm open to comments. I'm making an assertion that actually we our first experience as human beings is learning truth. They may not be even cognitive, you know, they can be just, you know, we're, as kids we're learning what things feel like and taste like as we're putting it in our mouth. But the way we learn is we learn from truth. You know, we don't start by doubting. There is an important aspect to investigation. The investigation is to bring the truth more and more into our lives. But sometimes in Western education, there's an overemphasis on doubting. So we stay in a kind of, it can be very sophisticated doubting too, by the way. I mean, we could be, well, I'm a post-structuralist, postmodern Michel Foucault kind of doubter, or a Diderot doubter, or, you know, I mean, we can get very sophisticated, cosmic, philosophic, continental French doubters. But, you know, the doubting piece gets almost like a cancer. We should be doubting certain things. You should be investigating, but the premise I'm making is actually we learn by establishing truths. And then we integrate them into our lives. We don't doubt, and then actually arrive at a truth. See, and that's the way we sometimes think like that. You know, we doubt, and then we'll come to the truth. But that's not investigation from a Buddhist point of view. Yes. Do you need the microphone? Yeah, you do need it. You do need it. We need you to need it.
I guess I would just suggest, for my personal journey of the ups and downs over the years, over the course of years, that the thing that resonated most with me is when you said that, you know, all of a sudden something just settles in, and you go, oh, that's it. Because, you know, you hear the same teachings over and over, and you, I've heard that teaching before. But every time you go, there's like something new or something, I don't know how it changes, I don't know why. But then it becomes true for you, and rather than the doubting part you're talking about, the negativity part, it's been more of a journey of test it out and see how it fits in your life. And then that's a way to accept the truth that you heard somewhere along the line in some teaching, but it didn't apply experientially to you until you actually had whatever the experience was to solidify that, if any of that makes any sense.
It makes sense. Yeah. Yeah.
And you talk about, you know, we learn this as a little child, you know, truth is truth, but it seems like the whole middle part is all muddled up, because then as you age, you know, there's some good part about aging other than the sore knees, which is bad, but it's like it becomes simple again, like you're a child. I know that sounds goofy or maybe Alzheimer-like, but it's like that,
mm-hmm.
I think, to some extent.
We do have a very strong tradition in Buddha Dharma of, you know, testing, right? Which is different than doubting. We, you know, have a strong tradition of debate, and we have a strong tradition of, like, what level of truth is that? Because we have actually different levels of truth. But the doubt that, you know, we could kind of call agnostic doubt a little bit is actually foreign to Buddhist practice. The example I like to use, I'm not wearing my fancy wedding ring right now, but I have a wedding ring with a few diamonds in it, right? So the example I give is if I was sitting like at the Middleway Health office and I came in and there was 5 diamonds, and then later on I looked at, God, this one's gone, right? I would probably look in the folds of my clothes and, okay, where'd the diamond go? Because I didn't move or anything. And maybe then I would go, oh, shit. And then I would maybe look in the chair, but I might not find it. The only way we'd really find it, in Buddhist kind of style, would be systematically blocking off portions of the room, maybe with like masking tape or something, into a little grid. And like when you didn't find it in maybe your 1-inch grid, you would block that off. And the important part is you wouldn't go back to look there again. And that's the classic kind of destructive doubt, is like, even though you covered it, you think like, I don't know, maybe I didn't really get it, so you look it again. If you go through that process of, you know, making everything into a grid, then you'll find the diamond. Because you knew it was there when it came out, so it's somewhere, right? You're going to find it because you've really systematically done it. However, if you don't find the diamond at all, what does that mean? Huh? Anybody else want to, like, if you don't find the diamond, well, Ian said it was never there. No, if you systematically look and you didn't find it, what's the conclusion? You lost it before you got there. You walked in the room with, you know, you're delusional. It's on El Amber Boulevard, or it's home, or, you know, like, you know, right. It's not there. But what we do as human beings, we usually kind of go a little nutty, like, I know I had it when it came in, so I just got to keep looking. And we'd probably, in some state of panic or something, go back and, you know, rip the tape up or something. Yes, we can. That's one way to go. Patty's got it. Yeah, we usually do a lot of blaming. That's usually how we do things. Or I did it wrong, or somebody else took it, or somebody gave me the wrong ring. But we establish for sure either we have it or we don't. So we establish a truth. The truth could be we never came in with the diamond, so... But we're establishing a truth. We're never establishing, and you know, like, I don't know, maybe it's still out there. If we have that sense, we'll look for the Atman. We'll look for a solid sense of self. Even the Buddha said there's no solid sense of Atman existing from its own side. But we'll look and we go, well, I didn't find it, but you know. Maybe the Buddha was wrong, maybe it's there, and I'll just kind of try again tomorrow. See, that could go on forever. So if you go about a proven methodology, which we can test on other things, like you could intentionally lose something and then find it with that grid pattern, then you have to accept the conclusion that it's either there or it's not there. This is a little philosophical, or is it really practical tonight? It's supposed to be really practical. It's supposed to be really practical, like, you know, so we're living from truth to truth to truth.
I've been told so many times, go look in that cabinet to pull out something, and I'll go look, and it's not there, right? I wonder if we'll say if it was a snake, it would have bit you. It was there the whole time. I'm like, no, it's not.
Yeah, like that. Yeah, like that. Yeah. Yeah, it's a minute. Yeah, that's it is exactly how it is. Yeah.
It was there the whole time.
It was there the whole time. Brian, in the back. Yes, but it has to go with the microphone.
And I lost it. And every year, first grade, second grade, third grade, fourth grade, sixth grade, I finally found it. I always looked. Every year I'd look for that little cowboy hat. And I'm getting ready to graduate sixth grade, move on to middle school, and I found that little hat. But then I didn't have the cowboy. But I persevered.
You did persevere. Thank you. That's now it says a lot. I appreciate that. Yeah.
Well, that brings a good point, though. In that particular meditation. That particular meditation, I mean, one time through ain't enough. I mean, one time through and not finding the self, you just go, what? No, I got to do that one again. I mean, one time through is not enough. You got to keep looking for that cowboy hat. And then eventually you don't find the cowboy hat and you're convinced that you aren't going to find the cowboy hat. But
or the cowboy.
Or the cowboy, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you were systematic.
It is a biggie. No, it is.
You went into that cabinet and you systematically searched that cabinet. You would have found it. Yes, you would have. When I went to New York City by myself and I didn't know anyone, and I left my traveler's checks in my hotel room because everybody told me I would get mugged, right? So I went out for a walk and I came back to my hotel room and they weren't where I put them. I did a grid search, but I absolutely established that they were not in that hotel room. There was, and that was the only way I was going to do it. I was completely freaked out, you know. One day I had some money, the next, you know, suddenly I didn't have any money. I was in a city, I didn't know anybody, I was by myself. And, you know, that's, and I do it with, okay, I lose something, and I'm famous for it. I'll look and look, I'll look at the same place 3-4 times. But if I actually, I finally say, okay, it's either here or it's not. I move every little piece, I touch every little thing, I move, oh, there it is. I will find it, if you're systematic. You just go look, well, I don't see it, well, you won't find it.
Good point.
You're systematic. You'll find it, or you won't.
Yeah, so, thank you. Yeah, I wanted to close with that, that it's so much a part of our tradition that we talk about path, right? We talk about the Dharma path, spiritual path. Buddhists like to say we're the most systematic, and you know that's why we have the teaching. So it's actually a system. The Buddha didn't say that you couldn't find it without a system, because you might just stumble on it. But the Dharma is like a system which makes it easier and makes it go faster. And that's the role of the Dharma and the teacher, to say you might find it on your own, but you might also run out of time. So you have a teacher and you have the teachings to make the end of the Dharma and the end of your life are the same. Gaining the Dharma goal. What do you think, Andrew? What do you think? Make sense? Okay. Yeah. Intellectually, okay. Well, even on a just, you know, kind of a take-home homework level, just really, really notice, like, what's really the truth for you? You know, what do you really know to be true? And you know, build on that. If you get really, you know, you can say, well, how do I know it's true? But really start with what you know to be true. So the Buddha enlightenment experience, just touched his hand to the earth touching gesture. It's just, I know this to be true. Start there. Okay. Can we do some this closing narrative meditations? Yeah.
So we're on page 15. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All-powerful Chenrezig, Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. May the teachings of the Buddha flourish, and may the upholders of the teachings remain forever. May all migrators achieve happiness, and may they fulfill all their temporary and ultimate goals. Losan, magical display of the deep awareness of all victorious ones. Merciful giver of a stream of profound and vast instructions to the fortunate migrators, please remain always unperishing, unchanging, unfading. Avalokiteshvara, great treasure of objectless compassion. Manjushri, master of flawless wisdom. Vajrapani, destroyer of the entire host of Maras. Tsongkhapa, crown jewel of the snowy land sages. Losang Drakpa, I make request at your holy feet. Now we also have the lunar practice at 9. So if you would like to stay for that, please, you're welcome.
Thank you, Lama.